From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, and today for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So, will Donald Trump be presidential? Will Hillary Clinton avoid coming across as a policy wonk? The two sparring partners enter the biggest ring of their lives tonight in what's being called the most anticipated presidential debate in U.S. history. And it may also be the most watched. It's estimated 100 million people will tune in. And Peter, we remember when everyone was so worried about putting the debate up against Monday Night Football. No problem, I don't think.
Yeah, and this morning, political consultant Matthew Dowd had some advice for the candidates in the final hours before their matchup. It goes a little like this, Robin. Have some tea and do some yoga or meditation and practice finding your safe place, which I guess means, what, that it's going to be a fight. There may be some fireworks.
Yeah.
Joining us now from New York are our analyst, Angela Rai, a Democratic strategist who is not working with the Clinton campaign. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
And we've got Paris Denard, a Republican strategist, also not working with the Trump campaign. Paris, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good. So, Paris, which Donald Trump do we get tonight?
I think we're going to get the Donald Trump who is, you know, leading in a lot of the polls, the national polls. I think we're going to get the Donald Trump who is connecting with the American people. We're going to get the Donald Trump who did well in all of the primaries against the other Republicans that ran against him. He is going to come ready and speaking with conviction and speaking with passion directly to the American people. So I think he's going to do and be the Donald Trump that we expect him to be.
Well, Paris,
passionate.
You say he's going to come ready, but much is made over the weekend about how Hillary Clinton was off at a hotel doing faux debates, which has been the tradition for decades, that he hasn't practiced. Do you think that that's really true, or is that just a fake from the Trump campaign? What do you think?
You know, I think what's really interesting is that Secretary Clinton is almost over-preparing. I mean, I guess she's just very nervous or threatened by Mr. Trump. But all these late-night cramming sessions, you know, she's really setting the bar very, very high for her.
Well,
I know Mr. Trump did yesterday. He met with Mayor Giuliani. He met with the members of the National Diversity Coalition, executive director. I know he also met with some other people from his policy team. So I think he's going to be ready.
Well, Angela, you take that because I wonder if Clinton could be at a disadvantage in some ways, because if she is as prepared as everyone says she is, the question might be, how do you actually prepare for somebody who is so untraditional, who may not himself be prepared in the normal ways?
So, Peter, that is the million-dollar question, or if you're Trump, it's the billion-dollar huge
$10 billion
question. And, oh, come on, Paris, we know better than that. But here's the thing. You can't prepare because you don't know what Donald Trump you're going to get. Paris talked about it's going to be the Donald Trump who's leading in the polls. Well, which one is that? It's going to be the Donald Trump that shows up at the rallies. Well, which one is that? It's the Donald Trump that shows up at the black church. Well, who is that? So we have a real issue here that you can't prepare to debate someone who gets raving reviews if he gets Twinkle Twinkle Little Star right? Like that's what we're up against. And I think the hard part about that is, Robin, is the fact that Donald Trump's standards are so low. They are completely different standards. On stage tonight, we're going to be judging Hillary Clinton by any eye roll, by any smirk or grimace at Donald Trump, by anything that she says where she might have misspoke just with one word. Donald Trump, on the other hand, gets judged by how hyperbolic he can be, on whether or not he screams at a woman candidate who's his opposition, not on qualifications, not on policy positions. They're two completely different standards.
Okay, well,
so I'm trying to figure out how we're going to even rate this debate.
You're not with the campaign, but that's the campaign line, Paris, that they're going to be grading Donald Trump on a curve. That,
absolutely.
As the campaign said yesterday, that all he has to do is not say something astonishingly unpresidential, and he'll have won. Whereas she, and by the way, a woman, you know, it's always said that has to dance backwards in high heels, she will have to have deep policy answers, and he won't.
Well, I mean, listen, she should have deep policy answers because she was Secretary of State.
But shouldn't he too?
This is what we expect from her. And I think that one of the things we want to say is what's important to point out is Donald Trump deserves to be on that stage. Donald Trump should be on equal footing on the stage, and he should be respected, and he should be judged just like Secretary Clinton because they are both our nominees. And so we should respect that and not just have a bar so low for Donald Trump that he's able to open his mouth and put together a complete sentence that somehow qualifications for him to be presidential. No, he's done things like go and met with the Mexican leader. He's gone to the black community. He has bested 16, 15 other Republican nominees to get to that stage. So he's earned the right to be there, and we should respect that.
But look, I think there is a question to be asked of how much policy are we actually going to get to tonight. Over the weekend, Trump tweeted that he would invite Jennifer Flowers to be in the front row. Of course, his campaign walked that back and said that will not be happening. But there are questions. You know, how much substance will there be in this debate? And Angela, how do you expect Hillary Clinton to address the issues of her husband's infidelity if Trump decides to go down that route?
So a couple of things. One is Paris talked about Donald Trump deserving to be on that stage. And I think this is exactly what political pundits like myself, where we have messed up this cycle. And what I mean by that is this. I have never taken the Trump candidacy seriously. And that is indeed the problem. That is why the bar is so low. When I look back on that, I apologize to the American people, because clearly we have set a standard that's so low where his supporters, and I think he's even gained additional support, where it's like, oh, well, they don't think he can do it. Well, let's rebel and show them that this dimwit could do this. And I think that that is exactly the problem. If you look back, and no insult to George W. Bush, but if you look back at the debate where Al Gore is sighing, right, during this debate every time George Bush opens his mouth, because it's like, oh, my God, how dumb can you be?
That's in 2000, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you look back at that debate, you're saying, oh, my God, someone who's really, really smart up against someone who's like everybody, you know, the people's man, the people's person, is really a problem. And I think that is exactly what we've set the groundwork for this time.
We got to let Paris respond. Dimwit.
Yeah, I mean,
he knows I think his candidate is stupid.
Well, okay.
I don't think that you can lead the corporate business that he's led and become the nominee and be stupid. I think that's, you know, a little step too far. But I will say that we should expect the unexpected when it comes to Donald Trump. We should expect him to be strong.
We should expect
him to really not be able to for Secretary Clinton to prepare adequately for what's going to happen, because he's such a different candidate. And he's a candidate who is really, really good at messaging, staying on the message of the moment, and also being able to pivot in that split second directly to the American people. So she should really just be prepared for anything and everything.
I think you're right, Paris. I mean, and Trump has never been on a stage like this before. He will be off teleprompter for 90 minutes. He won't be able to play off the crowd in the same way that he did during the Republican primaries, which a lot of people said helped him. Is that a danger for him, Paris?
You know, I mean, some people can say it's a danger, but we would hope that he's able to just engage directly with Secretary Clinton, and that the moderator doesn't overstep his boundary and act like he's the fact checker supposed to do more than just moderate the debate between the two and ask important questions.
This is Lester Holt you're talking about. Just to explain, Angela, and I want you to jump in. You know, this is the huge debate. I probably don't have to explain. Everybody knows that he has said that it's not his job to fact check. Other past moderators like Bob Schieffer said, well, no, if the other candidate does not correct a lie, it is the moderator's job to then step in and correct the lie. Angela, now that's part of what the Trump campaign is saying, that in people calling for that, they are trying to, what's the word they're using? Gaming the ref. They're trying to game the ref with Lester Holt. You say what?
So a couple things. One is I didn't hear Lester Holt say that it wasn't his job. I did hear the debate commission folks say that it wasn't the job of the moderator to do that.
Yeah.
And the thing that I would say to that is when you have a debate, you're supposed to be arguing the nuances about the facts. When you have to argue the substance of the facts, that puts us in a whole different realm. And to Paris's last immediate point, makes it so that Hillary Clinton has to prepare and be ready for any and everything. Hence her, whatever people are calling the over-preparation. But when you're debating 10 people in one human body, that is exactly what you have to do. You do not know what you're going to get.
But isn't that Trump's strength in a way?
This is not criticism to Donald Trump. It's me feeling for Hillary Clinton, which is to say, we don't know what she's going to be up against. And if the moderator himself is not putting himself in a position to fact check, then that means that Hillary Clinton has to also do that. And with the issues that she has with likability and whether or not people can feel her as someone that they could get along with, that's going to put her at odds with that.
Well,
so it's very challenging territory.
Of course, the Trump side says that she has places where she has been less than forthcoming as well. But we only have a little over a minute left. I want to ask each of you, start with you, Paris. What is the one question you want asked of Hillary Clinton?
I would ask, if I were Donald Trump, I'd ask Secretary Clinton if she would apologize to the American people for her statement calling over 14 million or half of the 14 million deplorable and racist and sexist, because I think that was a low moment for her.
Angela?
I'm sorry. I'm going to cheat. I have two. But since his candidate is cheating, I should be okay. Oh. So my first question – we know he's going to cheat.
The debate has already started, hasn't it?
Absolutely. All the time. We debate all the time, even on text. My first question would be, will you release your tax returns, Donald Trump? And my second question would be, are you willing now, at this point, now that you've held a press conference rolling out your hotel, are you willing to apologize to the President of the United States and the American people for being the chief spokesperson for the birther movement?
Okay. And by the way, Paris, we only have a few seconds, but that's intriguing. What do you need to hear from Trump on that?
I just need to hear Mr. Trump be honest and be open and stick to the issues and not distractions. I think a lot of the things that Angela brought up are distractions and not really what the American people want to hear about.
Oh, no.
Oh boy. All right. Paris Denard, Republican strategist, not working with the Trump campaign. Angela Rye, Democratic strategist, not working with the Clinton campaign. And you know what? Are you doing anything at 9 o'clock tonight? Because, like, maybe we'll have you back tomorrow to talk about it.
Absolutely.
That sounds like a plan.
Can't
Thanks,
wait.
You guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
According to government statistics, up to 78 people a day are now dying from opioid-related overdoses, and cities are trying to find a way to stem that awful truth. Here in Boston recently, GE joined the Consortium for Affordable Medical Technologies, or CAMTech, and Mass General Hospital to hold a hackathon. They invited doctors, activists, police officers, former addicts to team up over 24 hours and come up with ideas they'd then pitch to a panel of judges. Well, the winning teams took home $1,000 each to start turning those ideas into reality. Ideas like a Fitbit-like device that would detect when an addict was overdosing and inject life-saving medication like naloxone, which can reverse an overdose, or boxes placed around a city, which would open after a call to 911, inside more naloxone. Well, two of the winners of the hackathon are here with us. Scott Strode, who proposed a sort of community center, as we'll hear. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
And Aubrey Esters came up with sort of a mobile van. We'll hear more about that as well. Hi, Aubrey.
Hi there.
And let's start with sort of a bottom line here. You both are very public about the fact that you both have or are recovering from different addictions. Have I got that right, Aubrey?
Yes.
What was yours?
I was an active drug user for about 7 years. I was injecting heroin daily multiple times, and I was homeless. My life was absolute chaos at the time.
It's unbelievable looking at you now. It's just, you know, the reminder that it can happen to anyone.
Yeah.
Scott?
I got sober here in Boston a little over 19 years ago. Yeah. And for me, it was cocaine and alcohol, but it was the early days of the opioid epidemic starting to surface. And actually, once I got sober, I worked as an EMT, and I got to see the other side of it. And I saw OxyContin and these other drugs starting to emerge as opioid addiction grew.
In the patients on your gurneys, you know,
in your
truck. So you start with the premise that this is something that should be part of a public hackathon. This is not something that should be a secret. Scott, you told me you even have a T-shirt that says sober.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's beautiful that GE took this opportunity to pull together the hackathon to get a diverse group of minds together and go at this issue again, because the current approach we're taking isn't working.
Yeah.
And the issue only seems to be growing. So I think we need to look at it differently.
Albert, you say the same thing, right? Get it out from behind the dumpsters where people are dying.
Literally. I mean, people are literally dying in locked bathrooms, behind dumpsters, between cars. And it's, you know, the numbers are right now in Massachusetts between 4.5 to 6 people a day die from accidental overdose. And that's pretty bad.
As we said, almost 100 across the country. It's funny you mentioned locked bathrooms, because I understand one of the ideas was a detection device in locked public bathrooms that would detect when someone hits the floor, because it happens so often. Okay, well, let's start with your ideas, your winning ideas. Aubrey, what did you want to accomplish? And then we'll hear about your idea.
So originally, a group of us formed to work on harm reduction and in the greater sense, trying to help the most people in the highest drug use neighborhoods. And we were looking into supervised consumption sites or supervised injection facilities.
And some cities are doing that, you know, supervising where people need their injections so that at least they have clean needles, or if they overdose, there's someone there.
98 facilities around the world. 2 are currently in North America. want to are excited to be in Washington State, and it's something that's been happening since 1988, and it's time the U.S. got on board.
So you were initially looking at this, at least let's reduce the harm when someone is an addict, and then what did you come up with?
So we came up with a group that wanted to work at both harm reduction by educating people about safer use and also providing treatment on demand to meet people physically where they are and where they are in the process of recovery.
Talk about that, because people listening to you might be saying, and again, you did come up with a sort of van. We gave it away, a sort of a mobile van. But people might be saying, well, there are recovery centers. So what are you talking about that's not a recovery center?
So from my experience as a homeless person who was a drug user, I know that some people won't go to recovery centers because of the shaming and the stigma that's involved, a lot of times unintentionally from the providers there. And along with the fact that if they're not being reached out to by someone that they trust, they may not want to look into the services they offer. So our idea is to have a van that goes around multiple sites around the city that have very high drug use and reach people on the street who are homeless and using.
So what would be in that van? We've talked separately about the fact that there are some injection sites. This wouldn't be offering injections.
No. So this, we'd be doing basically the same things that a syringe exchange does, like a needle exchange, offering safer use supplies and education, along with treatment on demand, Suboxone induction.
Talk about that. This is MAT.
Medically assisted treatment.
Suboxone is one of the drugs that can what?
Suboxone and methadone both have been proven to decrease a person's chance of dying from overdose in their lifetime by 50%. And it saved my life, personally.
Because what? It allowed you to have something in your system that kept you away from the heroin while you tried to stay off heroin.
While I stabilized my life. Yeah, it keeps you away from more risky behaviors and active use. Enables you to not be sick, keeps your brain working the way it does after drug use for a long time.
So a couple questions about these vans that go around. And now you and Scott and everyone who won are taking these ideas out and fundraising for them to make it a reality. But what about a question like licensing? I mean, how do you have people go around and give out Suboxone in a van?
So licensing on a street level is something we're looking into. There are doctors already many doctors across Massachusetts that are able to and licensed to prescribe Suboxone or other buprenorphine. So we have several doctors on board already that are willing and able to do this. We're looking for other treatment centers and hospitals and health networks to join in. I've been contacted by places that have vans and have resources and are already doing medical work on the street that we want to include treatment on demand into their program.
Well, I want to turn to Scott Strode, who also won the hackathon here in Boston in the community building category. Now, in the past, you have been behind a push for community centers for addicts where they can go and box and do things like that and have a place. What's different about your winning project? It is also a community center.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. But I sort of took the concept of the third place, which is sort of a community building concept of, it used to be barbershops and churches and barbecues at family events where people came together and supported each other as communities. But the recovery community doesn't really have that. We have recovery centers, but they're very similar sort of in that treatment side, the institutional side of getting clean and sober. But then you're in recovery and there's this huge desert. There's a void. So we wanted to create a space that brought people together both early in recovery, loved ones, or even first responders who needed to learn more about resources. They could come in and talk to recovery coaches that would be greeters at the front door. And if you're struggling and you want to get clean and sober, you can come in and find access there as well. But it would also draw people that are in long-term recovery already.
Well, Scott, you make a point, because we have the treatment centers for people who've decided they've had enough. We have naloxone for the police and family who are going to reverse overdoses. But for someone who's in recovery and needs to now live with that, Aubrey, you tell a story of how you were in recovery for, what, 7 years?
Yeah, 7 years. And all it took was smelling someone cooking dope. And I was off and running. And I hadn't had thoughts of using for a long, long time.
You could have died that night.
I could have.
Yeah. After 7 years. So this is what you're talking about, Scott.
Yeah, I think that bringing people together who have some recovery time to be a support network for people that are new to the recovery journey is powerful, because this enhanced bridging happens. People start to find a 12-step community. They start to find a good therapist. They hear somebody who's in long-term recovery talk about what it's like to do their trauma work, which was the root cause of my addiction originally. Mm-hmm. And if you had a space where people came together, they could get healthy through yoga and fitness. They could get a job as a personal trainer or mentored as a coach. They could work in the cafe, maybe their first job in recovery. And they could also be a recovery coach greeting people at the door. And we put it in the heart of the city as a flagship that says, this is a place of hope. We're investing in this. We believe in recovery. And I think we can change that message and make Massachusetts the best place in the U.S. to be in recovery.
You know, I'm looking at you, and you are just a picture of health. You radiate optimism. But I'm betting there are listeners who say, oh, I know about those places. There's always, how to say it, a lot of men standing outside smoking. And mm-hmm. then there's the stigma. I mean, there's a misperception about what it could be. But then there's also maybe a stigma on the part of an addict who might be $200,000 a year executive and doesn't want to walk in a place like that.
And that's why this place would be different. It would be a vibrant place that is about health and wellness. Already, the nonprofit I work for, Phoenix Multisport, we're in 5 cities and 3 states already.
And these are with the units that you've set up for addicts.
Yeah, and we do CrossFit, boxing, yoga, strength training. It's all free to anyone who's 48 hours clean and sober. And this would be a little different. Even if someone's active in use, they could come to the third place and get some support.
Do you worry about that? Aubrey, your thoughts on Scott's idea. I'll ask you. Do you worry that an active addict going into a place like this might take down someone else?
So I'm not sure. I think it depends. I think having the 48-hour is an interesting idea. And I think we need to have as many options available as possible.
And Scott, your thoughts on Aubrey's idea of vans that would go around and, if she can get the licensing, even give out Suboxone, which is the medication that can help somebody wean off opioids.
I think it's a wonderful idea. And that's why I love that she was on the show as well, because a lot of people at the hackathon, the concept was around just keeping people from dying. And we absolutely have to do that. But her van also gives the opportunity as a gateway into recovery and some options for people to find out what resources they could access. So I think it's important to stop the fatalities right now, but we also have to find a path to recovery because that breaks the cycle of addiction.
We're going to link people to more about these and other ideas that came up at the hackathon. And by the way, listeners, we want to hear the innovative ideas that your cities are coming up with. But meantime, Scott Strode, Aubrey Esters, members of 2 of the 5 teams that won this year's first opioid hackathon. It was put together by GE, Mass General Hospital, and Camtech. That's the Consortium for Affordable Medical Technologies. Scott, Aubrey, off to fundraising. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, they're both talking to the movers and shakers they met at the hackathon for fundraising, but they both also have crowdsourcing fundraising sites. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org.
Airbnb is spending a lot of money to improve its image. It's an effort to counter the lobbyists, unions, and municipal governments that are going after the popular $30 billion home rental service. Here's an Airbnb ad featuring a San Francisco couple who called the company a financial lifeline.
I was diagnosed with Parkinson's actually in early 2013. It took a while to sink in. We had to think a little more seriously about saving money for the future and for the kids.
The income of Airbnb really helped to mitigate the stress.
But we have that flexibility of knowing that, you know, if things get worse, we have this to help keep us afloat.
So that's very, very important for us.
Here at Now Media, analyst John Carroll is here now to take a look at what's becoming a brewing ad war. And John, let's start with what Airbnb is up to there.
It's a pretty standard issue image polishing campaign. Airbnb gets a lot of criticism for providing incentives for short-term rentals that shrink the housing market, for bringing transients into local neighborhoods. What they're doing is trying to put a human face on Airbnb and also talk about some of the benefits to the individuals.
Yeah, as the company grows, it is facing challenges. You brought some of them up. It's also recently made changes to address some concerns about its host racially profiling guests. And
right.
It's also been accused of driving up rents in some neighborhoods, but you're looking at some information that shows that at least is not true.
Right. There's a data analytics site called 538.com. We'll have a link to it on the Here and Now website. And they've looked at it and they say the commercial units that are the ones that really take housing off the market are a small percentage of the overall short-term rentals. So they're saying that it's not having that big an effect on cities. But remember, there are 100 million users in 35,000 cities across the globe. So I think the jury may still be out on that.
And the company is still new. But also, there is another side to this as far as the ad campaigns go. Airbnb is getting attacked for dodging taxes. The companies are saying that they should be paying more. What's behind that?
Right. There's a group called the Share Better Coalition. It's a front group for hotels, the unions that work in the hotels, some municipal governments. And what they're saying is that Airbnb is engaged in a sort of a sophisticated system of tax avoidance. Mm. That's what they're saying in this ad.
Airbnb loves talking about taxes. They say, tax our hosts and we'll bring millions into your city. Truth is, it's just a slick marketing ploy by this multi-billion dollar corporation. What Airbnb doesn't like to talk about is they're running a sophisticated tax avoidance scheme. Airbnb uses over 40 tax shelters to funnel money from A to B. So your city only sees a pittance of what Airbnb is actually raking in.
So what they're saying is Airbnb is perfectly willing and eager to pay hotel taxes because it helps them to avoid corporate taxes, which are much, much higher. So that's pretty much the basis of what this attack is doing. There's some local chapters of this Share Better Coalition that are also on the air in other cities. There's a transit campaign in San Francisco opposing Airbnb. And then there are a whole range of social media campaigns that are going on there.
Well, the fascinating thing is both sides have a lot of clout, 100 million users for Airbnb, 35,000 cities, plus you've got the other side, millions of dollars behind that. So we'll see if anything actually really makes a difference there. John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now and a professor of mass communication at Boston University. We'll have a link to his campaign outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thank you.
Thank you.
And it feels as if the greats are leaving us. Every generation probably feels that way. But when golf legend Arnold Palmer died yesterday at 87, he was called the king, the guy who made your father feel he could be one too, even if he played a public course. Florida Marlins pitcher Jose Fernandez died on Sunday as well in a boating accident. He could have been king. We'll never know. But he was a crown prince, just 24, National League Rookie of the Year in 2013, twice an All-Star. Then there was Edward Albee. He died last week at 88, a voice stilled, a fist no longer shaking at the heavens. He won 3 Tonys, including one for Lifetime Achievement, 3 Pulitzers, best known for his 1962 play Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was later made into a film starring Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor as the sparring couple George and Martha.
You make me puke.
It wasn't a very nice thing to say, Martha.
That wasn't what?
A very nice thing to say.
Oh, I like your anger. I think that's what I like about you most, your anger.
We've spoken to Albee a couple of times. In April of 2007, when he came to our studios, he'd just been part of a forum asking if American theater had a future. So we asked him, does it?
Oh, it depends on so many things. It depends upon whether we ever start educating people in the arts again in our school system. Mm-hmm. Unless we can have a society that cares something about the arts and is informed about the arts, you can't possibly have people going to see serious theater or dance or anything.
You know, I forgot about that. You know, we were forced to put on some of the dramas in middle school and high school, and now look on back on that with joy.
Yeah, but the kids just aren't educated anymore. But the reason there's always going to be theater is the thing that distinguishes live theater from television and film is that live theater is happening to you, a real experience as opposed to a synthetic experience.
And a passive one.
Yes. You always know that film and television aren't true. In theater, there's that wonderful phrase, suspension of disbelief. Mm. You never suspend your disbelief in television or film. Mm. But if something is really working on stage and it's a live performance and you're there, You lose contact with the fact that these are a bunch of actors pretending to be people, and it's a fake set and everything, and all of a sudden you're in a real situation. Mm. And you don't get much reality in society anymore. You certainly don't get much reality in the arts.
What are some of the practical problems confronting theaters? I've heard, read you speak of cost.
The costs of everything have gone up terribly. That's because, I didn't want to talk about why, but...
What are some of the reasons why? I'll quote you. You say that when Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was first staged, I think I have this right, it was $45,000. Now
on Broadway, yes.
Yeah, sure there was inflation, but now...
And the inflation has not kept up with the rise of theater costs. The last production we did on Broadway cost $1.5 million. Mm. Everybody's salaries have gone up, of course, but the cost of renting theaters have gone up. The cost of advertising has gone up so much more than anything else. One-third of a budget for a play now is advertising.
Really?
One-third.
You know, even off-Broadway, where I started and where I started seeing theater long before I wrote plays, was $2 and $3 to get into a performance. Now it's $75, $80, even off-Broadway. And kids can't get there.
I've shared with you that I had a short theater experience in a play here in Boston, and I was astonished at the actors who, the commitments they made for the little money that they made mm-hmm. in return.
Sure.
And it's true, of course, of playwrights as well. You spoke to a master class for high school students at the Museum of Modern Art. What are some of the things they have to do?
They have to be willing to stay with theater in spite of the blandishments of television and film, where they can, at least in theory, make a great deal more money, even though they'll lose their souls doing it.
I was going to say, do you think you can do both, or does it corrupt your playwright?
You can't do both, basically, because you have absolutely no control over your own work when you write for television and film. There are other people that are constantly changing your work without your permission. The great thing about being a playwright is nobody can change a word of what you've written without your permission.
Mm. Although you've said they will try to make you take a play that's perfectly happy at 3.5 hours and make it 2 hours.
They will, but that's commercial. That's commerce. Unless you give in to the blandishments of commerce and hold the fact that this is a serious play and it's a certain length and it's about certain things, and I'm not going to make it simpler to reach the simple-minded. I've written this play for people of a certain intelligence and who wish to participate in something that's not going to make them giddy necessarily, except giddy with self-awareness maybe, which is great. And they have to do it on my terms. Hmm. That's the nice thing about theater. You don't have to sell out.
If you're just joining us, we're revisiting part of our 2007 conversation with the late Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Edward Albee. More of his advice for young playwrights included a list of pointers, beginning with, don't write too soon, get to know your characters.
Yeah, so many people start off and they think they've got a wonderful idea, and so they'll start writing and page 42, they stop. They don't really know what they're doing. They haven't let it gestate. It hasn't thought through yet.
Well, you gave us an extreme example of that when we spoke a couple of years ago when you were on the program. The example involves your play, The Zoo Story, with two men meeting around a park bench.
One of whom ends up dead by the end
yes,
of the play.
Yes, yeah. There's that. And there was a sequel of sorts, second act, if you will, called Home Life.
Well, actually, the Home Life is the first act of the two-act play, The Zoo Story being the second act.
But you wrote Home Life second.
I wrote Home Life 42 years after I wrote The Zoo Story because I realized I had two characters on stage in The Zoo Story, one of whom is called Jerry, who talks all the time, and we know everything about him. We don't learn very much about Peter, the publisher who was sitting in the park, and I wanted to know more about him. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting? Also, whenever The Zoo Story is done, I have to approve of whatever play is being done with it, and I get so tired of having to approve of plays. I said, gee, if I write a play, which is the first act, I don't have to approve anything
right.
anymore because I got to do the two together. And so I hadn't thought about the character Peter ever since I wrote The Zoo Story 40-some years ago. But I started writing this play about Peter at home with his wife, Anne, whom I'd never met.
In your head.
But I had her there.
Did you? That's what I mean.
I had her there because even when I wrote The Zoo Story, Peter had a wife. And obviously I knew who she was, but with going back to revisiting Peter, it was so simple to do. I knew who he was. I knew who his wife Anne was. I knew everything about where they lived, their environment. Right. I'd kept it in my head all those years, which is interesting.
So there's number one on the list, get to know your characters.
You really have to know them.
Perhaps not keep them in your head for 47 years.
Well, you don't have to keep them talking to you all the time, but as long as you have them there and you can bring them back. That's fine.
Here's some other things that Edward Albee said. You said to these students, write absolutely real people in real situations.
Well, unless you're going to write a real three-dimensional character, you're writing an essay. And unless you can write dialogue that is true to a real situation, you're faking it. You're writing ideas rather than people.
Let's see. Never lecture. Don't be obscure. Never become someone's opinion of you.
No, never do that. No, never allow yourself. I tell my students, every time you write a play, whether it's your second play or your 30th play, it's the first play you've ever written. You've got to begin all over again each time. So you're not influenced by what you've done, and you don't imitate yourself consciously or unconsciously.
So you cannot be when you sit down and write, you cannot think of yourself as Edward Albee, one of America's greatest playwrights, master of the acerbic dialogue as illustrated in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Writing my first play. I'd be burdened by comparisons, and I don't want to do that myself.
Just finishing out the list, you tell these young writers, every line has two purposes. One to One to delineate character, the other to advance the plot. Everything else is waste.
Yeah. You can't just go around wasting time. Plays exist in present time. And if you're vamping or wasting time, people become aware of it and they turn off and don't participate.
Four essential playwrights to read. Who are they?
Ah, the great 20th century playwrights, as far as I'm concerned, Chekhov, Pirandello, Brecht, and Beckett.
But you say read junk, too.
Well, I tell students, you know, if they're starting out, if they only read masterpieces, they're going to get pretty discouraged. But if they read some junk, they'll say, wow, I can do at least as good as that. Huh. So that's terribly encouraging. And also, you know, reading plays teaches you what to do and what not to do. And if you don't read junk, you won't know what not to do.
Our 2007 conversation with Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Edward Albee, who died September 16th at the age of 88, one of the greats.
Up to a million people, maybe more, are expected to watch tonight's presidential debate at a point in the race when polls have gotten very tight. A Bloomberg survey out today has Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton tied in a two-way race. So the question is, can 90 minutes on a debate stage make a difference in this marathon race? And Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us now, as he does each Monday from New York. Hey, Derek, welcome back.
Hello.
Hey, so a lot of people watching tonight. Any idea how many of them still actually don't even know who they're voting for yet?
It is very hard to say from the polls. When you ask people, are you undecided, you get about 5%. But some of the people who say they're voting for Trump or who say they're voting for Hillary are clearly changing their minds enough to make Trump and or Hillary go up and down the polls for the last 6 months. So some of those voters who are committing to one candidate are probably a little bit undecided. And then finally, in head-to-head polls, Clinton and Trump's numbers tend to cum to about 90%, which implies that about 10% of the country is picking some other candidate or isn't positively picking them. So that implies that you have many, many millions of people who, you know, might be Johnson-Stein voters for now, but once they see the main two candidates on the stage together say, oh, that's right, this is what this contest is about. It's Trump or Clinton.
So the issue is, what will the debates do to influence their minds? Political scientists have actually been looking at this. What have they found?
They have. And the answer for journalists like me is a little bit dispiriting because we like to create drama from any old event. There are several political scientists like John Sides, associate professor at George Washington University, who has for years sort of railed about this point, that debates matter more for the manufactured drama of the news cycle than they do for individual voting decisions. Debates don't just matter that much. He quotes a study by political scientists James Stimson, who found little evidence of any game-changing moments in any election between 1960 and 2000. And he essentially finds that a lot of the time that we sort of attach market-moving, poll-moving events to individual statements or individual gaffes, often with a bit of retrospective perspective, we can see that the polls were moving that way anyway, or perhaps some other proximate event was more responsible than the televised gaffe or statement for moving the polls.
Well, and we make so much of these debates, and you're saying, well, maybe they don't matter all that much at all. But I want to go to 2000 when George W. Bush was debating Al Gore. And Al Gore was criticized for appearing condescending. He rolled his eyes. At some points, he seemed to be laughing at George W. Bush. Let's listen to some of that.
Now, for every dollar that I propose to spend on education, he spends $5 on a tax cut for the wealthiest 1%. Those are very clear differences.
Governor, 1 minute.
Man's practicing fuzzy math again. There's differences. Under Vice President Gore's plan, he's going to grow the federal government in the largest increase since Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1965. And we're talking about a massive government, folks.
Yeah, you heard that really big audible sigh from Al Gore there. His advisor, Tad Devine, told the New York Times that if Gore had won that debate decisively, that he actually would have been president. So I'm thinking to this year, again, in a tight race, we've seen the polls tightening up. Does it matter more in a year like this?
By definition, if the debates only move the dial a little bit, then they are most important in elections where the gap between the candidates is, well, a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. But it's important to be clear that these debates, although they will be attended perhaps this year by Super Bowl-sized audiences, tens of millions of eyeballs, still, they don't stand alone in a voter's impression of the candidates. This is not Kilimanjaro on the Serengeti, where this one massive event is the only thing that people are aware of that they can see. The debate is more like K2, a large mountain among many other large mountains. Lots of voters have been paying attention to this election for months. Clinton and Trump might be the most overexposed candidates running for president in American history. To not know anything about them at this point would require a rather heroic effort. So again, I do think that if Hillary or Trump bombs, of course there is a cluster of people who are either vaguely supportive of one of the other or a little bit undecided and currently siding with a third party candidate. Maybe it'll make an effect on them, but there is not a dramatic and obvious historical precedent.
Well, the other
for
thing
a
is,
single debate moving public opinion.
And as you say, even if there were a major gaffe, we Americans, we voters tend to have very short memories.
That's right. So this is a really good point. Mitt Romney, by all accounts, was extraordinary in his first debate with Obama, absolutely cleaned the floor with him. There were all sorts of liberal commentators and reporters and people saying, oh, my God, Obama's lost the election with one debate. How can he do this? We all know what happened in November 2012. The president of the United States is not named Mitt Romney. So clearly there can occur seemingly dramatic moments that for weeks dominate the narrative of an election. Election, but by the end of the election, the narrative has changed because once again, an election does not consist of exclusively one event. It consists of many, many, many events of which the debate counts as one.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks for speaking with us.
You got it. Thank you.
And we'll have live debate coverage on many NPR stations starting tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern, along with live fact-checking at NPR.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service.
It's Here and Now.